Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A massive unemployment report surprise rallies markets. What was beaten down becomes this week's darlings. Coronavirus in the rearview mirror. Or is it? Plus, listener questions, all this, and much more on episode number 665 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey. Happy weekend. Good weekend. Happy summer. Welcome to June 2020. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as, of course, founder, president of Horowitz & Company, investment advisory firm. I'm so glad you're here with me this week and every single week since we've been doing this, going way back. I mean, way back. And, you know, when I start to think about where we are in the cycle, where we are with the enormous amount of news that has been just incredible over the last several weeks, months, kind of seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it, that we were talking and worried about the whole coronavirus and its impact on the stock markets and company earnings and global economies. I mean, even though we were talking about it, what, last week, right? You know, the thing is that in a way, the recent protests and the social unrest has really unraveled the whole idea of where we are and what we're looking at and what is the impact on the next several months and maybe even years. Our eyes have been taken off of the worry, even though, by the way, and if you check this, you'll see that we had some of the largest increases in case counts in various states around the country, around the world. Look at Brazil. Look what's happening there. Look what happens in the United States overall. There has been a lot more cases. Now, you might say, well, there's more testing going on, so that's okay. Yes, okay, fine. Still, we are finding more cases. The good news is, though, the hospital systems, which is the major issue here, are not overloaded. We're not seeing that people are on as many ventilators, per se. We're not getting those reports of heightened deaths. As a matter of fact, we're seemingly seeing that the case count is rising, especially or focused in the United States, but yet we're not seeing a lot of problems. Now, with that in mind, you have to wait a little while. We have to see how this is going to play out because this is one of those weird situations where it's everything's lagged. Seems like it takes 8 to 10 days to really find out how bad things are. Now the new wrench in the system is how much of the virus are we going to see spread from these mass protests and all these people that got together, whether they had masks on or not. There was a lot of people crowded into a space. Now, that may do one of two things. It may give us the idea that, well, you know, if we don't see a lot of or a significant spike in cases, then maybe we could start opening up sporting venues and clubs, and concert halls, restaurants a little further. Because if we don't see the incredible spike from this, there may be some evidence that, hey, you know what? It's a good thing. It's a terrible thing what happened. The protests are awful. The riots are disgusting. The looting is horrific. But if, in fact, this gives us a little bit of an experimental base that can provide us more details about what happens when people get together in mass and the outcome on the new caseload. And we have what? Maybe about 8 to 10 days from here to see from when the protests and the gathering started to see if there's going to be a spike in certain areas around the country, particularly in New York, of course, LA, Minnesota, in Florida, in Texas. You know, all around the places where we saw those incredible amounts of footage of people gathering together, protesting, so closely intertwined and at times really pushed together by the scuffling and police movement. That's going to be something to see. We'll also see if there is a spike in new cases with police, because they got into the faces of many of these protesters pretty tight. So this is going to be a big issue that is going to be out there for some time. My hope is that maybe somehow, miraculously, we don't see any significant increase, more than we're seeing right now, but a significant increase from what is going on around the country right now, because that would really be a setback. That would really be horrible. On top of everything, the social unrest and protests causing another wave, that would really be very difficult on a lot of companies that had hoped to get people into their place of business, retail in particular, and you know the list, the restaurants, the airlines, the cruise ships, probably stopped them dead in their tracks. If people see that there is a massive amount of new cases, and probably what's going to happen here, if we could for a moment try to speculate on what the news cycle is all about, is that we're going to see the continuation of the news about all the things related to what's going on right now with regard to the social unrest and the Black Lives Matters and the protests and the police brutality. Oh, we're going to see that for a little bit longer. And then the news is going to latch back onto, because they got to find something for the headlines. They're going to latch back onto the coronavirus. That's what they do. Let's find out what's the worst thing that we could talk about to scare the crap out of people, and let's put it on the screen. I don't care what channel you're on, what newspaper you're reading, what website you're watching. The bottom line is we're going to get back to that. And my hope is that we don't have to get back to it with the headline of, you know, 100% spike in cases or something crazy like that. My hope is, and hopefully I'm not just being too ridiculous here, that there really wasn't that much of a spike from all this. And maybe there is less of a concern right now going into this next level about opening up, and we can feel a little more comfortable. I, for one, I'm sure you are the same, have got to figure out a way that we can get beyond this, because it's become very stifling, very concerning. The inability to see friends and go out and socialize and travel and see family, and it's really a problem. I haven't seen my parents since March. Or maybe February. It was way back there. And Father's Day is coming right around the corner. I want to see my dad. And I don't know if we're going to be able to do that. Now, that's just a small problem, right? I mean, okay, I get it. You know what? If the worst is that I can't see some people for a while, okay. Let's talk about the other side of this. The potential for the economy to continue to have a lot of problems over the next, I don't know, 12, 18 months from this. While we are seeing the small amount of benefit from reopening, the grand reopening that's going on right now, the fact of the matter is that we are going to probably see a systemic unemployment problem for years to come. Earnings from companies, not across the board, but, you know, again, different companies do different things. You may see a sector of the economy, of the stock market, of the companies out there do really well, like we saw with the earnings from companies like Zoom and technology. And on the other hand, the problems you see with companies that are not going to be able to survive for one reason or the other, whether it was because they had poor management to begin with or whether because this just hit them so hard they couldn't do anything about it. But what I find so astounding right now is this incredible break. We've talked about this a little bit before, but this break from what is going on in homes and neighborhoods and cities and states around the country and around the world, for that matter, and stock markets. Did you see what's going on in Europe last week? Now, yes, Germany put out a package and bailed out Lufthansa Airlines, and that's a major part of the German DAX index. I mean, those markets were up 15%, I think it was, in the last, I don't know, 10 days. Pretty astounding. Now, our markets had a great week as well. I mean, we saw value blow past growth this week. But we're talking about 5, 6%, 8% returns on the week for small caps and large cap on the value side. The banks, the airlines, the cruise lines, the oil companies. So right now we have this break from reality of what's going on. Or I would say, I mean, the word dislocation is used too much, but a tale of two worlds. How about that? Where we have people suffering that are out of work, and it's a real problem. How are they going to find work? What happens if, in fact, we see that there is a stoppage or an end to the enhanced unemployment? What then? And I really am feeling that there is another problem that could be brewing. I don't want to get all about this, but you know what? We had the social unrest that was kicked off, of course, for those horrendous police brutality, murders. It's terrible. There's nothing that can be said good about the entire thing that happened. I mean, there's not one thing that you could say, well, no. But the social unrest was probably going to be there anyway. Whether it was that incident or something else. Maybe not at the level it is now, but you know what? People were stuck in their houses, forced to stay home, forced to keep their doors closed, scared out of their minds, and wanting to get out. Now, my concern right now is this incredible differential between the household of, quote unquote, the average worker out there and the other side, which is the affluent. I mean, are we going to have an Occupy Wall Street again? I mean, think about it. The stock markets are at a break-even point, or close to, for the year. I mean, amazing. Yeah, down from their highs, yes, no question about that. But an incredible amount of money opportunity was out there for people that bought into some of the lows. There's still some opportunity out there, of course, but nonetheless, there is a view, I think, that's going to start to be seen a lot more about, hey, wait a minute. Once again, the government, while they did bail out or help or assist the individuals out there, look who got the most of all this money. It was back to Wall Street again. Look at the Fed propping up junk bonds and buying basically assets in the trillions of dollars. I do worry about the continuation of social unrest. And then I would say that it may turn. It's gonna start to rotate from what we've seen about the potential for police brutality and the lack of respect for individuals in a quote-unquote police state and the concern for African-Americans and people of color compared to everybody else and how they're treated, what they get, but may rotate into, hey, look at all these richie riches making out like bandits while we're still suffering here. It's financial brutality, suppression. And that's a concern of mine because I think there's some truth to that. That's my concern. I'm not concerned about that for the markets. I'm concerned because I think there's some truth to that. And I think we all need to look at that and figure out how that can be adjusted. We know all the numbers about the one percenters and the half of the one percenters and how we see that there is this incredible amount of differential between the haves and the have-nots. Is that ever going to change? Because it just got wider. The division between the two has now become from maybe it was a little trickling brook to a river. It is a raging, absolute, just a riverbed that is just dividing the two so dramatically that you can't help to think that, you know, maybe we're going to see more of this. Maybe the more of the social uprisings and unrest that now focuses on a different subject matter because we need somebody to blame. That's the way it is. So the one thing we can say that when I look at what has happened over the last several months in terms of the economy, in terms of the markets too, the longer it takes oftentimes to enter into an economic recession or even growth, but let's kind of focus on the recession that we're in right now. when you look back in history and you study this, and I've done this, I've gone through this many times in my career, my lifetime. The longer it takes, when you look back at all past occurrences of recessions and slowdowns, the longer it takes to get into it, the longer it takes to get out of it. That kind of makes sense if you think about it, because we saw, for example, 2008. 2008 was a market crash in 2008, 2009, when finally there was a realization that, hey, man, things are not right. This started in 2006, 2007. Things were starting to slow down. It took 3 years, let's say, for the whole thing to wash out. It took 8 years for us to get back up. This one took a month and a half. And there was no precursor. There was nothing that was coming into this. Yes, I would make a case that earnings weren't going to grow as much as they could. I'll make that case. I'll make a case that the economy that was you know, laden with all that debt, that would probably maybe slow down a little bit. The Fed was pretty much out of what they're going to be doing at that point in time. So economic growth was going to stagnate for some time. Then we just turned the switch off. That's what we did, right? I mean, we did this sudden stop, turn the switch off, all done, all over, close the economy. Now, it wouldn't be a surprise if the economic recovery happened faster. Now, is it going to happen as fast? No. It's not going to be just a 1.5 month thing and then 1.5 month thing on the other side, right? We go from February down to March, and we go March through May. Already, we're longer than that already. However, the economy is not healed. The stock market may be healed, and the stock market is viewed as a forward-looking indicator. I get that. This is a unique situation here. This forced sudden stop and the inability for people to go out, even if they could, even if they wanted to, is much different than a slow slog through and into a recession where people are losing money, losing their jobs, things are closing up, they don't have choices. If they wanted to go out, they could, but they can't afford it, etc. There's a big difference. Especially because we got that incredible amount of stimulus that was flushed into the markets in a very hasty but yet quick manner. And that could be, that perhaps is maybe the difference between why the market is recovering so substantially and where the economy is and where the economy is going to be. And yeah, there were some snags in the whole stimulus package, but a lot of people got a lot of money. Individuals, businesses, bailouts. I mean, we're not talking about the $165 billion or the $500 billion or the $800 billion in 2008 that was about. We're talking about, I don't know, $5 or $7 trillion that was brought in. The Fed stimulus, $2 trillion, direct to businesses, lowering of interest rates down to zero, clearly helped. The Fed backing just about every asset class and direct investment into bonds, helping to, I guess, eliminate to a point the fear of bankruptcies. You know, if there was a concern by the markets there was going to be a stall and seize up of the financial system due to the fact that credit wasn't flowing properly, and now you have the Fed with $2 trillion able to say, hey, guys, you want to issue credit? Come on, bring it on. I got plenty of money. And the Fed doesn't care about price. They don't care about whether they're overpaying for something or not. They're going to hold this thing forever. It's all going to wash out. And with any stimulus that we've seen in the past, going back however long you want to do it, aside from just simply having a rate cut, although that's helpful because valuations change and there's obviously more money available to be borrowed at a very cheap rate, but with stimulus in the form of monetary stimulus and the amount that was pushed in, of course we know it's going to find its way into markets. Distortion? Yeah, clearly. There is distortion out there. Distortion of prices, distortion of valuations, distortion of reality. In fact, one of the noticeable things that happened recently is the massive increase in brokerage accounts that were opened. Did you see this? Have you noticed this? Have you heard about this? So the brokers that I've been talking to are all backed up. They're all having to bring people on. They're all having to put all hands on deck into the account opening department. A lot of them are small accounts, they tell me. A lot of them are first-time traders or investors. What does that tell us? Well, there's speculation in the market because finally, after a couple of years of the markets going up, there was this big break, this big drop, and there's a belief that, hey, man, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Plus, a lot of people are sitting home, not able to work, looking to make some money, so why not? Hey, if I could take some of the money I have, whether it's money that was in the bank already that was sitting on the sidelines, or maybe it was money that I got for a stimulus check that maybe I'm not sure if I need all of it, or I don't know, but they're putting it into the market. And you can see that. It's very clear. You look at trade size, you look at the information provided to me when I talk to a lot of these brokers, and it's clearly a lot of speculation. In fact, let me give you some examples of some of the speculation that's going on, because I think this tells the story. Now, this is not a complete look at the markets. Of course, markets in general were up. So was the large cap, the big companies, the solid companies, and of course, a lot of the speculative names also, but there was speculation last week. In fact, I track a lot of different news sources and information research. On briefing.com last week, they were talking about how, you know what, these kind of moves in the markets that we're seeing just this particular week, these blow off top type of looks, which, by the way, let me just take a second here. Hopefully I'll remember my train of thought because I want to mention this. We track something that I built called the Key Reversal Indicator. What it is, and it does one thing and pretty much one thing only. It calculates a variety of indicators, psychological and technical, and looks at where we are from a market point of view. In other words, step back and let's take a look. Where are we? Are we in a really oversold or overheated environment? Are we in a equilibrium state? Are we trending a little bit towards the oversold, trending a little bit towards the overbought? Usually those levels, they go from a negative 7 to a plus 7, 0 being market in equilibrium. All right, you got that? So we were at a negative 7, a negative 6, a negative 5, a negative 7, all the way through March and April when all that was going on, primarily March, let's say. And as a matter of fact, these were some of the lowest numbers that I've ever seen. Because usually you get one or two of these and then it resolves. One, it's a daily number that comes out. One or two resolves. Maybe it goes from a negative 7, but it goes to negative 3 after that because people see that as, but they see that the markets are kind of oversold here and they start to pile in. Okay, so we saw that go on a lot during March. We saw these numbers, these negative 6s, negative 5s, kind of the back up the truck kind of numbers we want to see. But again, it kept on falling and falling until we finally reached that point on March 23rd. Okay, so here we are. Now we get the turn. Markets start going up from March into April into May. This week, for the first time ever, and this indicator goes back, and I've gone back daily to 2010, I believe it was, when I can grab all the different pieces of information that I need to make this calculation. We have never seen a plus 7, ever. Now, mind you, when you see the plus numbers, they're not as powerful, in my opinion, as the negative numbers, the oversold numbers, because people, usually investors, want to buy. That's just what they do. They want to buy more than they want to sell. You want to hold for the future. That makes sense. They're investing, right? Okay, so when they see prices drop, they're like, hey, you know what? I'm going to buy. When they see prices go up, you know what they say? I'm going to buy. When they see prices really go up, you know what they say? I'm going to buy. So that's the average investor out there, the average mutual fund, the average institution, generally speaking, with a few exceptions. But I've never seen a plus 7 twice last week. I think it was on Wednesday and Friday, plus 7. Wednesday, we get that plus 7. Of course, Thursday, we see a little bit of drawdown. Friday, we see the plus 7 again. I have never seen a plus 7. Now, again, it's not as strong as a signal as the negative, because again, when negative happens, people say, hey, it's overdone, it's oversold, we got value, I want to buy. But the plus 7, twice. It is not a back up the truck and drive away moment, okay? Sell everything out, cash out, trade it into cash. But it is something to be aware of when every other indicator that you know logically is overdone. Valuations are out of control, right? You see that technical indicators are getting crazy and speculation is rampant. So getting back to that point, some of the things that we saw last week, for example, when we look at this, and this is something, again, from briefing I mentioned, where they talked about how the speculative move that was going on and the stocks in particular that were being bid up, are those the sign, they are the sign of retail frothiness, of exuberance. So, for example, we had companies like Hertz. Hertz. Do you know something about Hertz? They're bankrupt. They're going bankrupt, out of business, up 157% last week. And you can say, well, Andrew, it's a low base and all that. But who is buying Hertz? Not the institutions. They don't want to be caught when this thing finalizes and they wipe out the shareholders and common stock. Unless all of a sudden Hertz is going to get bailed out, not going to go bankrupt. Maybe somebody knows something. Possibly. But come on. You're not going to have people that are professionals bidding up Hertz in that manner. As a matter of fact, Carl Icahn bailed out of it recently. Now, with that concept of bailing out, we also saw things like Warren Buffett pretty much calling the lows in airlines, bailing out of all of his airline positions, saying there's going to be massive amount of earnings degradation. Is that a word? Earnings are going to degrade over the next number of years to a point that he doesn't feel that he can hold them. Last week, the airlines, 30 to 50% or more. American Airlines was up like 45% in one day last week. Again, who's buying those? Now, you may say, well, traders and people who think that they're not going out of business and all that. But yeah, I get that. But the amount of money that piled into these airlines over the last 5 weeks, 4 weeks is unbelievable. Look at the net assets of the ETF Jets, J-E-T-S. And you can see what I'm talking about. Rampant speculation regarding prices. Well, it's not really anything more than, hey, it's down, I'm buying it. Luck in coffee. Fraud. Conviction. Delisting. Up 155% this week. And sure, as a day trader, yeah, there's opportunities, and why not? I mean, if you're a day trader, why not take those opportunities? But as an investor, what does it say about the markets? This exuberance, I mean, does it feel familiar? Companies that aren't going to have earnings for God knows how long, up 40 or 50% in a week off their base. And you can say, Andrew, well, wait a minute. These are down 80% for the month, for the 2 months, whatever period, year to date. So just driving them up 50% is really not that much, but I agree with you there. I agree with you. But when we start moving Hertz up 150% and Luckin Coffee up 150%, you know, hey, congratulations if you own those at the bottom, not at the top, because you're still down probably 70%. And that's just this year. So congratulations to you if you traded those and you bought those. But I got to ask, is that a sign that we need to put into the checkbox of frothiness of the market, considering the KRI indicator, considering valuations? I'm just saying. Now, I've been talking about how markets are overvalued, and I think the valuations are a little bit nuts for a while, with the caveat that I don't necessarily believe that you should be net out of the market. I've been talking about that. Didn't we talk about that 2 weeks ago? The whole idea of the hokey pokey, 1 foot in, 1 foot out, dollar cost averaging in through a variety of different ways, time-based and opportunistically. Right? We talked about that. So I don't think you necessarily should be out of the market. So don't misunderstand what I'm saying here or misinterpret it. What I'm saying is I don't feel like being exceptionally bullish right now with all the facts that are in front of me. If I did, you would say to me, Andrew, what's wrong with you? You would question my intelligence, I think, but you'd also question my motives. Buying it at a price, I mean, how long does that frothy speculation and that action last? It won't last forever. I can tell you that. I've seen it before. But it can last a lot longer than we think. We've seen that before as well. So there's not anything of a surprise when it comes to that. So consider that. Consider all the things. Look at this and then realize, you know, that you're thinking, hey, you know, maybe things are a little hot and all. But again, that doesn't mean that should prevent you from investing, because again, we don't know what else lies ahead right now. We may get a clean bill of health and the whole deal about the protests and the social unrest and the people close to each other may not really do anything much for the coronavirus. If it does, that's another story. And if it does, is that going to affect the markets? So Let's separate all this and think about investing for your future. And with that, I want to mention something. Because we've had a pretty, knock wood, we've had a pretty good year so far. A lot of people have been taking us up on our discussions about becoming clients. And I thought that some of you that may be on the fence thinking about, oh, I don't know if I want to move into the markets or not right now and all, and I don't know what I want to do. And well, here's what I want. I'm going to give you a little, just a nudge. During the month of June, all new accounts opened with our Investology program, you know, the advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced program. This is an investment platform that we have. We'll get a signed copy of my first book. And yes, there's me on the cover with this 1980s mustache, although this was 2007, I did this, 2008. You will get a copy of that, a signed copy of that, and an Investology challenge coin. So anybody that signs up with a new account on Investology, and for those that you don't know what it is, well, you can go to Investology, which is Envestology.com. In a nutshell, basically, it's a way of us bringing our institutional global allocations that we have for clients to everyone. $10,000 minimum. You have a range of risk profiles to choose from. This is a kind of a robo-esque type of platform where you can answer a variety of questions that we put together and an algorithm that we built to try to come up with what is the appropriate risk for you, considering your overall risk tolerance and time horizon, and then build a portfolio around that. We do regular rebalancing. And of course, the bigger issue is that we hunt and search out what we believe are some of the best money managers out there, as well as ETFs. So you get a lot of institutional-based mutual funds. You get ETFs at a low cost. It's a program that you really should check out. Check out Envestology.com. Something else I want to mention, we started those Monday pop-up Q&A webinars that I do. It's a webinar where you can ask any question you want, and it's at 4:30 in the afternoon on Mondays, and I started this at back, I guess, in March. Thinking that, you know, there's a lot of concern out there. People are really worried about what's going on. Let's have a forum where we can all get together and we can have a two-way conversation. Whereas a podcast kind of, you know, we can answer questions, which we're going to get to in a minute, but it's still not live and right there. And if you hear a question, you're like, oh yeah, I want to ask that. And you can ask something else and add on to it. So we started this and I thought maybe we'll go through April. That's what I thought. I said, you know what, as long as there's interest, we'll do this. And the interest has been unbelievable. The people that have come and the questions that have been asked. So right now we extend it through June. So you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the top right, there's a little button to click that says, hey, register for the webinar. If you want to come in, any question you have about finances, investments, your opportunity, well, it's free. Ask the financial guy. That's what this is. So you can come over and do that. We're going to do this at least through June. That's what we have scheduled right now. If we see that there is a packed house on a regular basis and people are getting a lot out of that, well, we'll continue it on for a little bit longer than that. So check that out. That's the Q&A pop-up webinars that we do at Horowitz Company over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can register for that. All right, let's focus for a second on, before we get to, we're going to get to some listener questions, a couple things I want to talk about. First, there's a great chart done by Charles Bellello, and he got information from Trading Economics, and he talked about the global growth rates over Q1 and Q2. And I went down this list, and it looks like Q1 in the U.S. is about 0.2. We're going to have a negative 16 year-over-year estimate on Q2 at a minimum. But if you look down this list, it's pretty horrifying. The only one that seems positive right now is India. Where's China? Now, China looks like it's going to be a negative 4. Q2 is negative 6.8. Q1 on a real basis. And you look down this list, the worst is the U.K. with a negative 26. I wonder if of course, the Brexit had anything to do with that. What else do we have that's an outlier here? It looks like pretty much everybody's in this 10 to 15% level. I mean, across Europe for Q2, we're looking at negative 18%, negative 17%, negative 11%. Turkey, Russia, 13%, 8%. So it looks like we're right in the middle of all this, UK being the worst and India being the best. So we'll see how that plays out. We're going to start to get some of that detailed information not too long of a pace from here. All right, let's focus on the unemployment report for a second. There's a lot of questions about what happened on Friday. The idea that we went from 14% and ticked down to 13%, 13.3%, I believe it was. And we saw another 2.5 million people added. That's right, I said added to the payrolls, where we're supposed to see somewhere in the neighborhood of about a negative 8 million. What happened? I mean, what happened here? I mean, so do we really think that the unemployment rate ticked down in May after all the initial claims numbers that we saw that were so horrible and the continued lockdowns? And even though some states opened up a bit, I mean, do we really think that we saw a plus 2.5 million? Or does that seem logical? Seems kind of unlikely to me. So suffice to say that there were some reasons that we can pick apart this report, like the 9 million people that were pulled off as no longer in the workforce. That's 9 million. So if you had them as unemployed, it probably would have had a much higher number, probably another 5%. But those 9 million were pulled off because there's a question on the unemployment and said, hey, are you looking, are you actively on the forum, are you actively looking for work? And the answer is no. And that could be because you were furloughed. That could be because you can't. That because you're in a mandatory lockdown. So there's going to be some weird numbers coming out of this. And this question that was answered on the forum, it seems that this 2.5 million additions, I mean, maybe we've only been down 6 million. But still, this 13% seems a little bit ridiculous. And we're going to have to see how this plays out when things get back to normal. But the truth is that most of these economic numbers that we're seeing right now, you have to take them with a grain of salt. Because there is the inability for a lot of these reports to get done due to the lockdown, the whole stay-at-home orders during the period recently. So a lot of these are going to be, I would say, questionable. So just think about that. Don't get too worried or excited about anything. I mean, the markets were excited. We had, an incredible day with the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. We had over 2.5% day, 3% day on Friday due to this number. But let's also realize there are structural changes in the system, jobs that will be permanently lost. Yes, there'll be new industries and jobs gained. Sure, I have no question about that, but there's a healing process. This doesn't go from just a, it doesn't do a V. We're not going to do a V. Let's get that straight. It's just impossible right now. We're still shut down. We're still closed down in parts of the country, at least partially, not shut down, partially shut down. And a lot of people, even if things are opening up, are reluctant to go out and do things. So all these economic indicators right now, a little squishy. But nonetheless, next week we'll see CPI, inflation, on the consumer level. PPI, inflation at the wholesale level. Probably not moving very much. We'll see that early part of the week and mid part. FOMC, rate decision on Wednesday. Probably not much going to be done there. But I am sure, I'm certain, I'm absolute, they're going to once again renew their commitment that low rates will be on for a long time. Forever, potentially, it seems to me. I don't know. The big thing is going to be whether or not they're going to hint at negative interest rates. That's something that there was a lot of talk about. Now, with the jobs number they saw on Friday, I would venture to say unless they really want to put up an alarm that something was really wrong with that report, they are not going to talk about negative interest rates. In fact, this gives them a little bit of cover to stay away from that for a little while. On Thursday, we're going to see the initial claims and University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index on Friday, the first read. So we'll see how that goes. With that, I asked you to send in some questions. Of course, you could do so at any time over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew button and just ask away. But I have some questions that I want to go through here. So let's buckle up and do that. And our first question comes from Robert. He says, "Hi, Andrew. I like your show." I guess he doesn't love it, but he likes it. "I've submitted a question before. It's been a great market, but still trying to get rich. So I came across a terrific topic that I would like to hear your take on, and I think that it'll be great for your show. It's about infrastructure. There was a terrific feature report from S&P Global highlighting the need for an overhaul of infrastructure. It is perfect time to take advantage of low commodity prices. It would create a lot of jobs and strong growth in the long run, and it's a hot topic of Trump's campaign for re-election. I hope business is booming. Thanks for doing the show." And you're quite welcome. I don't know if there's a question. or if this is a statement. But either way, I think I would echo the thoughts on this. I think that, yes, we are in a desperate need for infrastructure development. The problem that you have right now is you have to, I think, first of all, get the states back in order. Because a lot of the infrastructure, of course, happens at the state, county, city level, right? So one thing we do know, it's pretty easy to issue bonds right now. But a lot of those bonds that are going to be issued to bring money into the state, cities, and municipalities are all going to be to repay for the losses they have for all this downtime, all this extra expenses without revenue. Secondly, if we're going to do infrastructure, I would hope that would be some kind of grand plan that's well thought out here, because what are we going to hit? How is it going to benefit? Where is it going to go? And realize that, of course, in the construction and the building business, there's often a lot of leakage. So probably it would be really helpful if we had some kind of inspector generals that were unbiased, apolitical, that were put in charge of a lot of these projects on the municipal level or wherever they're going to be emanating from. And yes, we need to fix the bridges and tunnels and, you know, get new transportation sources across country, et cetera. So I do think that is going to create a lot of jobs. No question about that. I mean, think about that. That could be a major way to create jobs for those people that want to work in that area. My only concern is when we have government involved in something like this, and the numbers will be enormous. The concern I have is the leakage and the misappropriation, misspending, the way this goes. So there has to be some kind of, I would say, oversight that is reliable and well thought out. So I think it's a great idea. I have no question about that. This next question comes from Tim B, and he says, I realize everyone's risk tolerance is different, but from the prioritization standpoint for your own money, would you keep some cash, maybe 15% of the portfolio, on the sidelines for a potential future pullback, perhaps in a 45 to 90 day time frame, or tactically use some cash secured puts for maybe dividend stocks that are traded towards the lower end of their support levels? Historically solid companies, reasonable valuations with strong balance sheets, and still make profits with the same mentioned time frame. But you only had to prioritize one. Oh, well, I think the sell on the puts, if that's what you're thinking about doing for some companies that are interesting, if they get down there, you want to buy them, especially those that are high dividend. Not a bad idea. I don't have any problem with that. And that pretty much sets you up for your first question, which is keeping 15% on the sidelines in the event there is this pullback. With utilizing the selling of the puts, you did both at once, didn't you? You got cash, more cash that came in from the sale of the puts, and you're willing to buy those prices at a lower price. So I don't think that's a crazy thing. I think, in fact, that's a pretty smart thing. You get a little bit of income stream coming in, and I think on top of that, you'll have the cash that you want. You could always sell the puts or buy the puts back if things don't work out, or just let them expire. And then you get the income. You could do it over again. So whether you're going to do it, you know, on a 2 or 3 month rolling basis, I think is a pretty interesting idea. Let's see here. Next question comes from Rod. Rod says, hey, Andrew, I have a question concerning negative interest rates. You mentioned that possibility a few weeks ago, and Frank Curzio said he thought it could happen during the fast pitch segment last week. Question: how should a mutual fund investor invest the fixed income portion of a diversified portfolio in a negative interest rate environment? Investing short-term money in an online savings account or buying a mason jar in the backyard and going all in on equity-based dividend-paying mutual funds, with the rest seeming like the only answer. But that would violate our written investment policy, which calls for a 60-40 equity fixed income split. You got a lot going on here. The question is, do you revise your income? Your investment policy statement of 60-40 if we go to negative interest rates to take advantage? Because when you wrote your investment policy, you did not have negative interest rates in the discussion, did you? Probably not, because it wasn't possible. It wasn't there. So if, in fact, you believe that you should be more in equities under that circumstance, if that's the case, well, maybe you should revise or at least put an addendum saying that in unusual times, we may be able to expand our equities to maybe 65 or 70%. Maybe. I'm not suggesting you do this, but I'm trying to give you some advice on what to do when you have an investment policy that is that structured. So that's something that I would look at. The second thing is that, you know, realize that when you have negative interest rates, there is an initial knee-jerk reaction for bonds to come down pretty significantly in terms of the yield and the prices to go up that much more significantly. And that would be good for bonds. And especially you'll see that in the mid part of the belly in the short term to a degree. Long term also. I mean, you know, you'll see that come down as well. I think it's a really bad thing. I think that really sends, number one, a really bad signal that the economy is much worse than it is, which it probably is. But secondly, you'll never get out of it. You'll never, never, never dig out of negative interest rates. And it causes a massive distortion in things over time. Hopefully that helps. James writes in, "Hey, Andrew, thanks for your two wonderful podcasts." You're very welcome, James. "My question is that I'm working as an underwriter for several lenders on a PPP program, processing thousands of applications. And I hear from borrowers things like the things are really bad for small corporations, a lot of small corporations. As a prior banker, I always noticed that the bell-shaped curve of small businesses, that the left side of the curve was poorly capitalized and weak cash flow and generally poor management financial skills. If those millions of businesses do not manage to survive this crisis, how will that impact the stock market and the real estate market? Will the bottom of the supposed U-shaped recovery be many months or several years?" So right now, as we look at it, James, I think this is a loaded question with a lot of meat in here, and I think that there's not one specific answer because a lot of things that are happening, like how much more stimulus is going to be put out there? How long is this, you know, confinement, containment going to go on? Will it be further social unrest that really wrecks everything that we've been working on trying to stay home for the last couple of months? I do think it's going to be you, a general you. The question is, how long is the bottom? That's, of course, what you're looking for. I think it's going to take a long time for economics to get a lot better. We'll see a bit of a spike when things open back up. But again, that's a relative spike off a very low base. In terms of small businesses, the lifeblood of our economy, there's going to be a very different recovery for them compared to the large businesses. With all the money that's available and the ease of access for funds in the open markets for many of the big businesses out there, it would seem to me that those businesses are going to be able to capitalize much better and, in fact, in a way, dominate. And many small businesses are going to feel the pain from that. Think about the Amazon effect on a lot of businesses over the years. Think about the Netflix effect. Think about Walmart and a lot of retail areas. And what's happened with the major chains and the mom-and-pop restaurants. Small businesses don't have a chance these days. And with all that has recently happened, that left side of the bell curve, in my opinion, is going to be even longer and shifted more to the right. And yes, a lot of small businesses are going to have problems. And hopefully, if we do get this thing open and people feel comfortable to come out and do their thing and interact with small businesses that are able to do business in a way that they were doing business before, we could see a decent recovery off of this bottom. But again, I think it's going to be a slow slog for a long period of time. Now, a long period of time, you know, could be a year till we get back to decent levels. And right now, we're probably seeing a little bit of a W. We're going to see this spike down, a little bit of spike up, and then down, and probably a little bit of a U from there over again. I don't know, it's like an upside down square root. It's like a swoosh in a little way, but a little bit of a belly there on the right. I don't know. It's some kind of crazy non-letter at this point that we could really describe it as. But I agree with you that small businesses are going to have a much more difficult time unless they can figure a way, which will be difficult, to overcome all this. Next question is from Jesse, and he says, "Hey, Andrew, back on podcast 637. When is that? Last November, he says. You spoke with Robbie Mills on how ESG analysis was gaining popularity. I was wondering if you could revisit this, as I would love to hear your thoughts on the S&P ESG Index ETF, such as SNPE, versus the traditional S&P SPY. It stood out to me that SNPE does not distribute a dividend, among the differences between the two. Thanks, and hope your toe feels better." Yeah, that was a couple of weeks back. We got a little crazy with the toe. Hey, thanks, Jesse. I guess we can get Robbie back on. I'll put that as a note here. ESG, everybody's doing a lot of greenwashing. As a matter of fact, if you watch Billions, it's even got into that program, the idea of taking companies that are not environmentally or socially or governance-wise conscious, the ESG letters that stands for, and they're looking for any way to become ESG positive, green, because that would then allow them to be into these various indices, and then people that are investing and feel that, hey, you know what, I want to feel good about my investments. They need to make me feel good. And yeah, I want to make money on them too, but I think if they make me feel good, they'll make me money too. Okay. I don't know. Call me old-fashioned. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But nonetheless, a company is as good as their management. Of course, the governance part of that is important. But the environmental and social, okay, that's important. But I think the governance is the big issue there. So if they clean up their governance, that's one thing. The other part, yes, we want a greener, we want everything. Listen, we want the environment better. We want social change. I got all that too. I'm not putting a negative on any of those things. I'm just talking about how we're going to see a greenwashing of companies pretending to do those things so they get a better ESG rating and therefore allowed to be invested in a variety of places. But I'll put that down on the notes. We'll get to that. Let's see. This question comes from Joe. Joe says, I'll be brief. What's going on? I don't think anyone has seen Wall Street so sanguine. My question is this. When the Fed prints so much money, does it actually devalue the price of stocks? For instance, if the dollar is really only worth 70% of its value, does that make stock 30% cheaper? It makes the stock 30% cheaper in other currencies. You won't see it here. In fact, that would be an inflation style, and you'll see stocks go up. When the Fed is printing money, it creates the illusion that stocks are worth a lot more here. Look what happened in like Venezuela when their stock market was up, I don't remember the number, like 1,400% or 14,000%, something crazy when they were devaluing their currency. And the problem was if you invest in it from outside, you would have a loss. But if you were in the inside, maybe you'd have this massive gain. But then your currency wasn't worth anything and there's nothing you could spend it on outside of the country. So you're stuck inside. The Fed's debasing of the currency is what is called in the U.S. theoretically will have some benefits because it will make our currency cheaper and therefore make a tailwind for earnings where other countries around the world and companies around the world would want to purchase our products because they're cheaper. Now, they'll have to do some kind of a hedge if they actually get into our currency under your scenario here, but it doesn't really necessarily cause the problems that you're thinking about if you are a U.S. citizen based on the dollar holding U.S. stocks that are based on dollars. If you're a Canadian and you're buying a U.S. stock and the stock does not move in value, stays at $50, but the currency goes down 30%, you're down 30%. So it all depends on where you are, what your perspective is. Final question comes in from Tim. He says, as part of your portfolio, do you put some of your investment towards angel investing? What percentage would you use? If you can get some angel investing and you're a small investor, I would probably say you don't want to do that. Now, I don't know what your exact definition, what you're thinking is angel investing. Angel investing is usually pre-first round investment in a company that hopefully will have some future that you can get into the next level and kind of go through the process and eventually IPO and make all sorts of money. Usually you need a big chunk of money to do so. There are some companies out there that will take like a crowdsourcing, I'm not really a big fan of that necessarily. If the company can't get money through normal channels, why would you want to be a part of a crowdsourcing when people are putting in $500 or $250 or $1,000? It's an interesting way of getting money and raising money, but I think that if you have a decent product and you are the angel side of things, early investors are very aggressive, very risky. We don't do it, no. There is no publicly traded option to do so, and that's the only way that we invest for our clients. Thank you for all the questions. I really appreciate it. That's going to do a wrap for the week. Of course, anything you want to ask me, just go over to the site, ask me, be a part of the conversation. The Horowitz Company pop-up Q&A webinars on Mondays at 4:30 in the afternoon, and take me up on the book offer. Signed book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, and an Investology Challenge Coin for everybody that opens up an Investology account in the month of June. Very easy to do. You can check it out on investology.com or go to my.investology.com. You can register, play around with it, check it out, see what's going on. No requirements to do anything until you go through the whole process of setting up your accounts at TD Ameritrade. Until next week, I wish you well. Have a safe week. Have a profitable week. I'll see you again next week. Of course, before that, GH Unplugged on Tuesday nights, 9 o'clock. Myself and John C. Dvorak. But anyway, hey, I'll see you again. So long. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.